Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. We really appreciate you supporting our author events and for supporting us. It's always a pleasure for me to introduce Pam Houston, as I love her writing, and I read her new novel, Contents May Have Shifted in a Day. I couldn't put it down. I found myself, and I had the galley, and I found myself dog-earing pages and passages and nodding and tearing up and laughing out loud, as I usually do with Pam's books. She has a great gift for storytelling from the soul, and from Cowboys Are My Weakness all the way through to Sighthound, Waltzing the Cat, she's taken readers on travels through bad love affairs into life of a contemporary nomad, and she splits her time between Colorado and California and still finds time to fit in world travel in between her busy schedule. I hope you, if you haven't read any of her books, I can recommend all of them because I have them. She has her own special spot in my bookshelf room. So please welcome Pam Houston.
Hi. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for driving around and around to try to find a parking place. That's me in the loading zone. That was me. But it's okay, it's a rental. So they'll never find me. I've spent a long time writing this book, 6 years. I don't know if any of you heard me read at the Evil Companions evening at the Oxford, but that was the very beginning of this book. And basically, the writing of this book started when I was invited to the Wisconsin Book Festival and asked to be a part of an evening called Unveiled. And the assignment was to read something that was completely untested and untried. And I took the assignment so seriously that I didn't start writing until I got on the plane to Wisconsin. And I wrote really hard and fast on that plane, and I had about 48 hours once I got there to work. And in my panic, I did what I always tell my students to do, my writing students to do. If any of you have taken a class from me, you've heard me say this. Just think about the things that arrested your attention, that glimmered at you, that spoke in that voice that says, "Hey, writer, over here, write me down." And I didn't have a story to tell right then before Unveiled, so I just did that. I wrote down 12 little mini stories, things that had arrested my attention, that had grabbed me in the last little while. And I titled them with the places that they occurred. So I titled them Georgetown, Great Exuma, Ozona, Texas, Juneau, Alaska. And I have always thought in 12s. I'm not sure exactly why, but I've always thought in 12s, and so I did 12 of them, and that was about a 25-minute reading, and I read them. And they bore relationship to each other because they were all noticed by me. They made a kind of a story together, as I suspected they would, though I didn't intentionally arrange them to form a story. And I read them, and I'll tell you one other kind of funny thing. Right about 3 hours before I had to go on stage, and I mean, I was up all night, and, you know, it was one of those high adrenaline sports. And I said, well, I'll just look at the email to see if it says anything, you know, else, if I met the assignment. And so I looked at the email, and it said, "The only caveat is that you have to mention the state of Wisconsin." And so I was like, shit. So I threw out Goosenecks of the San Juan or whatever, and I went down onto the street in Madison, Wisconsin, and I sat there and I waited for something to happen. And eventually it did. And so then I went back upstairs and wrote it down and substituted in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was on my way. But anyway, that evening, a writer that I admire a lot, Richard Bausch, said, that's great, you should do 100 of those, and that's your next book. And I thought, well, not 100, but 144. And only 6 years later, here we are. And that book is in form. And it's called Contents May Have Shifted. And there are 132 very short chapters that are named with the place they occur. And there are 12 that take place no place on an airplane. And I'm going to start out with one of those, if I can find it. This is Delta 55. The airplane stories are named with the call numbers of the airplane. The plane is gradually but perceptibly descending. It is barely light outside, and we aren't due at Orly until nearly noon. There is an odd ticking noise coming from the wing outside my window. I come fully awake and realize we are listing strenuously to the right. I glance at my seatmate on the aisle. Her name is Rebecca. She is a 26-year-old bank teller from Cincinnati who has never flown before, who has saved for 5 years to take her dream trip to Paris. I spent most of dinner telling her how much safer airplanes are than car travel, how the 777 has a minimum of 3 fail-safes on each of its major systems, how even if one of the engines fell clean off the fuselage, it is designed to tumble backwards, up and over the wing, so it doesn't tear the wing from the plane. Now, in spite of all my reassurances, we seem to be heading shoulder first into the North Atlantic. Ladies and gentlemen, the pilot says, as many of you are probably aware, we are descending, preparing to make an unscheduled landing into Reykjavik, Iceland. Approximately 35 minutes ago, we experienced an explosion in our number 2 engine, and that engine is now inoperable. The ticking sound you hear is the wind running through it, spinning the blades backwards, much like a household fan. You can probably also tell that we are tacking toward Iceland, much as we would in a sailboat, as our current engine configuration will not give us full power in a straight line. Now Rebecca is awake and looking at me wild-eyed. The man likes a metaphor, I say, and offer a small smile. The light out the window has strengthened, and I can see white caps on an angry gray sea. I always kind of wanted to go to Iceland, I say. But by now, Rebecca is no longer looking at me. She has her eyes closed tightly, has given herself, I imagine, to prayer. We will be landing in approximately 15 minutes, the captain says. Please give your undivided attention to the flight attendants as they instruct you in landing in the brace position. I like that he did not say crash. I like that he's a language guy. The ocean is getting quite a bit closer, no sign of Iceland out my window, and I hope that Reykjavik Airport does not turn out to be a metaphor for fucked. Just when it seems that our wheels have to be skimming the water, land and runway lights appear. And then more of them. So many lights, it is hard to count them. A sea of spinning red and blue, every ambulance and fire truck in Iceland seems to have come out to greet us. Holy shit, I say, just before the wheels hit the foam and the foam splashes up and covers all the windows, throwing the cabin in a half light, exactly like waking up in a tent after a snowstorm. And then everyone is cheering as the plane glides to a jerky, sticky stop. Much later, in an upstairs blank space of terminal as we are being fed rice with some kind of yellow chickeny goo all over it by something resembling the Icelandic Red Cross, the crew tells us the reason for the emergency equipment. When the number 2 engine exploded, it spit jet fuel all over the fuselage. We were a Molotov cocktail hurtling through space, is the way the literary pilot puts it. There was no way to be certain that the friction of the tires on the runway wouldn't make a spark and ignite us, turn us into a 90-mile-per-hour ball of flame. This is chapter 25, Ban Zhang Hai, Laos. My guide Zai and I are standing in the warm mist of a Mekong River morning in the village of Ban Zhang Hai, Laos, watching an unusually tall Laotian tend his boiling vats of lau lau, the rice wine moonshine that has put his village on the map. Monkeys scream in the trees above us, and a gentle-faced woman stands nearby holding a glass I fear is meant for me. It is slightly after 8 a.m., and in America, that would be a good enough reason to decline politely. But here in Laos, where decorum is far more rigorous and complicated than it is in America, I'm pretty sure there isn't going to be a way out of drinking the pickled Mekong water that is about to come from the steaming, rusted 50-gallon drum. I reassure myself that no respecting amoeba could possibly live in 80-proof hooch and quickly down the glass of white I am offered, which gets me another glass. And then a glass of red, which I realize the second it goes down my throat without searing my tonsils isn't nearly as strong as the white. I am seized with regret, flooded by premonitions of feverish vomiting in a Laotian healthcare facility. I do what any sophisticated world traveler would do and stuff an entire antibacterial wipe into my mouth. And during the tour of the brightly painted temple, suck every drop of juice out of it I can and swallow. Outside the temple, a beautiful woman is making ferns and bougainvillea and daisy petals out of colored paper. I buy a small bouquet from her and ask if I can take her picture. She says something to Zai, and he translates. She says she should take your picture because you are the beautiful one. And I can tell by the tone in his voice that he thinks she is mistaken. Zai is the most formal guide I have ever had in Asia, which is saying a great deal. He had been a monk for 3 months at 18. Then he became one again for one day last year when his mother died, so he could carry her body, he says, to the other side. His English is impeccable, except that he says electric city when he means electricity and comfort table when he means comfortable, and anyone can see why he would think that was correct. At least twice a day, he says, if I am not speaking right, you will please graduate me, but I rarely do. I'm pretty sure I have managed to eat the antibacterial wipe clandestinely until we were back on the boat heading downriver to the magical city of Luang Prabang, and Zai says, have I told you yet how the Buddha died? When I say no, he says, he was invited to the house of a friend for dinner, and they were serving pak. Pak, I say? Pak, pak, he says, mildly impatient with me as usual, and he makes an oinking noise in his throat. Aha, I say, and Zai smiles. He knew the pak was bad, Zai says, knew even that it would kill him, but he ate it anyway because it was most important not to offend his hosts. I guess that's the difference, I almost say, between Buddha and me. But on the off chance that Zai has paid me a compliment, I smile out at the muddy river and nod. This is 67 Denver, Colorado. This morning at Ruby's house, the kids are playing Would You Rather. And Marla, whose weight is currently at the bottom of her 50-pound cycle and is therefore all cleavage and ponytails, says, Pam, would you rather look like you do now forever or get wise? Get wise, I say, no brainer. What if you could look like you looked when you were 25 forever? Same answer, I say, and Marla narrows her eyes. Rick always says, you are so beautiful on the inside, except when he says, you are so beautiful when I'm inside you, which Cinder tells me is even worse. Well, says Marla, what if you could have all the wisdom of a lifetime and still look like you looked when you were 25? Or what, I say. What, she says. I say, I thought we were playing Would You Rather. She twists her head like a dog at a foghorn. Marla, I say, you get the wisdom because you don't look like you did when you were 25. She says, you don't understand the rules to this game. This is 59, Tucson, Arizona. I have not been on the property 30 minutes when I am lying on a massage table in a softly lit, frangipani-scented room with a person named Trevor towering over me. I can see, he says, that you were doing a lot of spiritual work because look how far you are out in your hair. His accent is vaguely South African, and he has the most impressive unibrow I have ever seen. I do not read poetry, Trevor says, because I live poetry. He picks my feet up and lets them fall back to the table. May I ask you, he says, why the lower half of your body is perpetually standing in ice-cold water? He means energetically, of course, because the room is warm and my legs are dry. And what happened here, he asks, not waiting for an answer. He has his hand on my leg at the exact place where, when I was 4 years old, my father threw me so hard against a big oak wardrobe that I broke my femur. The bone healed 40 years ago. I was casted from the tip of my toes to my armpits for months. But Trevor is not the first healer to be able to see what happened. My father, I begin. I am not afraid of your pain, Trevor says. I am not afraid of your grief. I am not afraid of your anger. Sorry, your terror. You want to know why I'm not afraid of your terror? I nod. I am not afraid of your terror because I have gone inside the monster, and inside the monster is pure wonder. Somewhere in this building, my friend Willow, who I have come to Canyon Ranch with, is getting a nice, simple lavender scrub and an herbal wrap. Willow looked through the catalog, thought, yes, the first night, maybe a nice herbal wrap after all that travel. Pamela, Trevor says, will you tell me your father's name so that I may ask him to excuse himself from the lower half of your body? Yes, I say, and I do. Sebastian, Trevor says, Sebastian, you must get out of there. Sebastian, he says, this does not belong to you. He has his eyes closed and his hands tight around my ankles. No, Sebastian, he says more forcefully now, there are no options. We stay like that for an excruciating amount of time. Then he folds my hands across my chest and covers them with his. If you could have only one thing, he says, would you choose peace or ecstasy? Ecstasy, I think, though I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to say peace. Peace is an illusion, Trevor says. I am in the ecstasy nearly all the time now, even when I sleep. He seems to have fallen into some kind of trance. Pamela, he says suddenly, slapping the bottom of my feet with his palms. Yes, sir, I say, out of habit. He's got my wrists now, is stretching them back over my head. No one has ever called me Pamela except my father. You have two glasses, Trevor says. One is completely full and one is completely empty. In which glass is stillness possible? The full one, I say. The questions are getting easier. Trevor now has his powerful thumbs wrapped almost completely around my uppermost vertebra. You can get to stillness through ecstasy, he says, but you can't get to ecstasy through stillness. I think about all the ways the language of the New Age is custom made for terrorism. I think about when a pink mouth opened in a white sky over Davis, and I saw for the second time the cupped waiting hands. When one of the doing lines in your life intersects with the circle of your now, Trevor says, what happens? It has to bend, I say, confident now. It bends and bends and eventually becomes a circle. Precisely, he says, and releases his death grip on my neck. This is 60, Istanbul, Turkey. At the Sultan's palace, beautiful long-limbed girl, sexy but not too sexy, lots of brassy hair, surrounded by 7 or 8 international travelers her age. To an Australian boy with acne scars, she says, you are walking through the Topkapi Palace with 3 beautiful women. What more do you want? The other young women are not in the same room of beautiful as she, but they accept the compliment, don't dare to interrupt. The boy says, maybe if you were all naked, and laughs. One of the other girls, a Swede, says, no, meaning, go fuck yourself, acne face. The brassy-haired girl holds her fingers to the Swede's lips, says, my parents taught me never to say no immediately. To men, the Swede asks. To anything, she says. Istanbul is the only major city in the world that is situated on two continents. Since 330 AD, it has been the capital of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Latin Empire, and as recently as 1922, the Ottoman Empire. In the hilly streets, ruin leans into palace, leans into internet cafe. We are in line waiting to get into the harem. Miles of tiled, low-lit corridors and rooms so thick with ghosts of women in captivity, you can feel their hair on your arm, their jasmine-scented breath on your face. In contemporary Istanbul, the dervishes have finally invited the women to whirl. In the Blue Mosque, there are 250,000 tiles the color of sky. When the sun comes out, inside is sky and outside is golden. I am 46 years old and ashamed of the fact that this is the first mosque of my life, but later, when the evening call to prayer catches me in the garden between the Blue Mosque and the Hagia Sophia, call and echo, echo and answer, bouncing off domes and turrets that have stood on this hill for 1,500 years, I know faith springs out of doubt like topsoil, and one thing I am is here right now. Across the Golden Horn, where the Bosphorus meets the Sea of Marmara, the Asian part of the city glistens in the twilight. As a candidate for the center of everything, Istanbul beats Pueblo, Colorado, hands down. The gulls are turning cartwheels around the towers of the Blue Mosque and cawing like crazy women. Byzantium, I say to them, Constantinople. The circle of my now is wreaking havoc with the lines of my doing. I am learning to say yes, if not always immediately. A sweet-faced Turkish boy, maybe 19, offers me a Kleenex, puts both hands over his heart when I take it, says I look just like his mother when I cry. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Driving from Chicago in the -6 degree weather, neck craned out the window looking for the lunar eclipse because the rocket scientist told me to, but the light pollution extends all the way to the Wisconsin border, and I think I'm probably facing the wrong direction anyhow. If I became the rocket scientist's girlfriend, the fortune cookie about me being the reasonable one would never, ever, ever be true. In Milwaukee, everything is frozen solid, the river, the stoplights, even my car door. But when I get to the high-rise hotel room, there is the eclipse right out my window halfway over and looking strange enough to scare a caveman or an ancient Egyptian to death. Trish comes to meet me for breakfast with her sperm bank in vitro baby, and I have no idea how to respond as she details all the ways her life has become a living hell. She knows I thought she was crazy to do it at her age, alone with her 80-hour-a-week job, and now here she is, as if to prove me wrong, but everything she says makes her life sound about 10 times worse than I could have even imagined. The lake is frozen as far out as you can see. Blocks of ice heaved up on the shore like wrecked cars, and Cliff Parker, whose law firm is sponsoring my visit, picks me up and takes me to the Milwaukee Country Club for lunch. It is so much like the country club in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that my father could just barely afford to belong to. It takes my breath away. Only it is like it is still 1972 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The white wallpaper with little parasol-toting maidens doing tour jetés across it. The four dead gray-haired ladies propped up in the corner as if to look like they're playing bridge. The place probably seats 250, not even counting the no women allowed grill downstairs. And yet, other than the dead ladies in the corner, we are the only ones eating today. The point of this luncheon, I quickly understand, is so that Cliff can show me why he is a lawyer and not a writer, to show me the kind of life he gave up writing for. He has invited 8 people to the luncheon besides the two of us, and exactly none of them show up. I can't decide if Cliff Parker is a sociopath or just so completely normal that he is incomprehensible to me. Our waitress is actually named Trudy. She has a beehive hairdo and is at least 114 years old. We both order the Cobb salad, and for some inexplicable reason, it takes 45 minutes to arrive. The room is being heated to a sultry 85 degrees, and there is a squirrel hurling himself repeatedly at the floor-to-ceiling window behind Cliff's head. Over and over, he climbs the nearest tree and then flies, flying squirrel style, and lands splat with his face against the window, where his paws achieve suction for a little more than 1 second before he slides like a cartoon character down to the bottom of the glass. He does this 5 or 6 times before I comment on it, though it makes such a terrible noise every time he hits, I can't believe Cliff doesn't turn around. Probably rabid, Cliff says with a casual wave of his hand, and I feel my eyebrows go up, and he says, a lot of the squirrels around here are. This is 80. Portland, Oregon. Rick says, Pam, if everyone deserved a down pillow, there wouldn't be any more birds. That was Portland. This is 111. Trenton, New Jersey. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that my back hurts so much because when I was 4 and in my 3/4 body cast, my mother found it easiest to carry me around upside down like a monkey, using the plaster bar the doctors had fashioned between my knees to keep them for 3.5 months the correct distance apart. And let's say she did just that until my second to last appointment, when the orthopedic surgeon said, "You haven't been carrying her around by this bar, have you?" And my mother shot one quick glance at my father and said, of course not, no. And it became a funny story the two of them liked to tell together to friends over a couple of drinks. And let's say that when their friends asked, as of course they would, how in the name of heaven a 4-year-old breaks her femur, they said that I had somehow managed to pull the giant wardrobe over onto myself, except instead of wardrobe, they would have said credenza, because it would have made us sound richer than we were. I still don't see how it would make me feel any better to think of the pain in my hip and spine as anything other than my most loyal and valuable companion, the continuous non-voice in my ear that says, you got out alive and you still get to go. No two people who have ever lived loved to travel more than my mother and father. They gave that love, in their fashion, to me. I'm going to read one more, but before I do, I will just tell you a teeny bit about the arc of this book so you understand what you're hearing. The narrator, Pam, is obviously looking for some answers to some big questions. Most of all, she's looking how to live bigger and broader and better and more generously, I think. She has a lot of good girlfriends, a lot of really good massage therapists, a fantastic acupuncturist who you actually haven't heard about accidentally tonight. I'm trying to read something a little different every night. And she also has a boyfriend early on named Ethan, who's not so great. And then she does some internet dating, which doesn't work out very well. And then she meets Rick, and she and Rick have a very difficult relationship for a while, and they struggle to kind of make it right. And Rick has a daughter named Madison. And I think that's all you really need to know to understand what I'm about to read, which is one more airplane story. And this is TG, Thai Air 944. Once upon a time, I decided to take Ethan around the world. It was probably an ill-advised decision. Let's just say that when I saw the email to his third most important other girlfriend 2 weeks before we left, the one that said, Pam is dangling this round-the-world trip like the proverbial carrot at the end of the fishing pole, I wished I had my $14,700 back. We went to Paris, Bangkok, Bhutan, Perth, Alice Springs, and Sydney. And I suspect that in reality, it was a pretty wretched trip. The betrayals revealed, the breakup imminent. There was likely some screaming and crying. No doubt tensions were high. But here is what I remember. The little boy pouring himself a shower from a bucket in the labyrinthine canals of Bangkok. The sign in a cafe window in Geraldton that said, "Lost kangaroo, beloved pet and dog's best friend," and a number to call should the kangaroo be discovered. The middle-aged Italian singing happy birthday to me on the airport bus at Uluru. Ethan's smile, backlit by the sun, coming through hundreds of white prayer flags on top of the Dat Chu La in Bhutan. Also this pleasure, flying over the part of the globe I had not flown over before. I had flown west to Asia, east to Europe and Africa, but everything east of Germany, everything west of India, was in my imagination a big blank space. The Thai Air 747 from Frankfurt to Bangkok traveled mostly at night, but there was a nearly full moon and snow in the mountains. According to the computerized route map, we would fly over Moldavia, Ukraine, Russia, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. I stayed up all night while Ethan slept, knowing that though life is long and every time I get 10 bucks ahead I go somewhere, this was still the best view I would ever get of many of these countries. Afghanistan was mostly snow-covered, treeless mountain ranges dotted with occasional flashes of red, possibly infrared light. I am 39,000 feet above a war, I thought, the closest I have been in my lifetime. These days, Rick wonders aloud if I will ever grow up enough to realize that everything I'm searching for on the other side of the world I could find just as well at my own kitchen table. Maybe someday, I say cheerfully, except that I can't. Sophie told Madison she doesn't like to fly. Sophie is Madison's mother. Sophie told Madison she doesn't like to fly, the she, of course, being Madison. And when Madison reports the conversation to me, I say, "Do too," and she says, "Do not," and I say, "Do too," and she says, "Do not," and I say, "Do too," and then we tickle each other. Last week she said, "I don't know what all I got from my mother, but what I got from you is not to be grossed out by things." Madison will be 9 years old next Saturday, which means I have known her for exactly one-third of her life. We get her from Sofree for 24 hours at 5 o'clock, and we are taking the Amtrak up to Winter Park to play mini-golf and ride the Alpine Slide, which I realize is not exactly the Orient Express, but it's something. I think about the places left to go, Mongolia, Namibia, Sri Lanka, Yemen, and have grown up enough to realize it will be good not to get to all of them. Also to recognize the two long straws I drew in the psyche lottery. I have no memory for the really bad stuff, and I've never quite understood shame. The first time I saw the Earth get made, cool from lava to black glass to something called Hawaii, I didn't think I would cry, but I was mistaken. Eventually, on that long night over the parts of the globe I'll never see, the sun rose over Myanmar, and in Rangoon, where the Yangon River meets the Andaman Sea, the turrets and domes of the temples lit up as soft and gold in the early light as a fairy tale. Thanks. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to answer some questions if there are some. Yes?
When did you realize you were a writer?
When did I realize I was a writer? Oh, boy. Well, there was sort of like a being a writer and being a writer. You know, I wrote always. I wrote from the time I was an only child of alcoholic parents. And so I wrote when I learned to read when I was two. I had this wonderful nanny named Martha Washington. We didn't call her a nanny. We didn't have enough money to have a nanny. But she hung out. She was a babysitter who never went home, basically. except on rare occasions. And her name was Martha Washington, and she taught me to read when I was 2 1/2 by paying me a nickel to read cereal boxes and milk cartons and signs and stuff. And so even right then, I was telling stories. I was writing stories. I don't remember a time that I didn't make sense of the world by writing a story about it. But that's very different than being a writer. You know, I always wrote. And I honestly don't know. There was a moment on my first book tour, actually. You know, when your first book comes out, you think someone's made a terrible mistake, and you're going to get caught. You know, they're going to realize that, you know, that they were mistaken, that you like faked it so well. You know, and so the whole time, Cowboys Are My Weakness was in production, and you know, once it was out of my hands, there's this waiting period. And I just thought, they're going to know. They're going to find out that I'm just a graduate student who doesn't know anything about anything except my stupid boyfriends and running rivers, you know. And then the book did really well, you know. Surprisingly well. It was a surprise to everyone, but no one more than me. And there was this one night I was in Chicago. And I remember this just really clearly. It was early in the tour, but it was late enough in the tour that everybody could tell that the book had taken. And I was coming down the elevator, and you know, I was going to say I stayed at Motel 6. Well, not even. You know, I stayed in my tent or the back of my car. So all of a sudden, I'm in these fancy hotel rooms, and like a limo is picking me up. All these things are happening that is so beyond my understanding, And I looked at myself in the mirror, and I mean, this isn't really much of a story. I'm not sure why I'm telling it to you, but I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, oh, you're a writer. You know, I know you. You're Pam Houston, the writer. And I think of that moment all the time. That's the first moment I think of, but I'll tell you one more that's a little more of a story. A few nights later in Seattle, I spoke to my now deceased and beloved editor, Carol Smith, and she made me call her every night to tell her how it went. How'd it go? How many people were there? How many books did you sell? You know, which it's like you're not really keeping track, you know, honestly, but she always wanted to know. And the paperback rights had sold that night for, you know, for a nice amount of money, nothing massive, but a nice amount of money. And it was, of course, more money. I was a graduate student, you know, so it was like, it was so much more money than I imagined having. And it's what I bought I put the down payment of my ranch with in Creed. And she said, you know what this means, don't you? And I said, no. I was thinking I can pay off my, you know, my visa. And she said, it means you can be a writer for the rest of your life. And that was really powerful. So those moments when I sort of owned, but you know, I'll tell you the truth, I'm still doing it. You know, I just turned 50. I just turned 50, and thank you. I bought makeup for my 50th birthday, and it helped, I gotta tell you. I waited, you know, so that it would really make a difference when I finally committed. I went to, my friend took me to Nordstrom's, you know, and they taught me how. It was good. I don't wear it every day or anything, but I got it on now. Anyway, I just turned 50, and I was thinking, well, maybe now I'll stop apologizing. You know, like, maybe now I'll stop thinking, oh, I gotta prove I'm really here, you know? And here I am, you know, 5 books later, and that's still, like, it doesn't ever, like, you never get really anointed. It's always you're always trying really hard to prove. And I think that's probably the good news, you know, for an artist. You don't ever want to think you're too good, probably. Yeah?
I'm a huge fan of Sighthound.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if there are any dogs in your life.
There are dogs in my life. In fact, I saw them this morning. There are 2 wolfhounds in my life, Fenton and William. And if you look on my Facebook author page, you will see lots of pictures of them because nobody likes anything as much as they like the dogs in the Facebook world. I just learned how to do Facebook like 3 months ago and Twitter. and I'm learning Tumblr, and I'm feeling pretty good about myself, you know, like teaching an old dog new tricks. So anyway, you can see them there on the Facebook author page, and they're excellent. One of them got very sick, of course, the second I went on my book tour, a terrible infection he couldn't be cured from, and my very good friend Linda drove all the way from Truckee, California to Creed to make sure that he was getting the best medical care. And now she's driving him right now. She's in Salina, Utah right now, in a Super 8 with them, in bed with her, I'm sure, Linda and two wolfhounds. And she's taking them to Truckee because she believes that she can take better care of them than the people I have staying at the ranch, who are great people, but Linda's the real dog mother type. So anyway, I got to see them. I was in Durango last night, and I got to see them. So that was good. But yes, two Irish wolfhounds, Fenton, who is elderly. He's almost 9. And William, who is 9 months. And much better. Much healed by Linda's constant petting and putting ice packs on his forehead and things. Cold cloths on his forehead. Yeah. Oh, sorry. You go first, and then you.
I'm a fellow writer. It's great to hear you read your work. And I have just done poetry and a personal essay and memoir.
Uh-huh.
And been sort of flirting with that idea of moving into fiction. It's mm-hmm. getting closer and closer. And when you read your work and you tell stories of, you know, mm-hmm. sitting there waiting for something to happen, for instance, in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
I'm just really curious where it moves from the experience of your life into the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about
sure.
how that happens.
Yes, I can. You know, all of my books have been autobiographical, and 4 of them have been called fiction, and 1 of them has been called nonfiction. And there isn't an essential difference between those. In other words, the book of essays is not more true than the other books. This is where I live, you know. It's where other writers live, too. I didn't invent this place. When I was becoming a writer, Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, was very important to me, and one reason I decided to call the character that's based on me in this book Pam is sort of an homage to him and that book and him calling himself Tim in The Things They Carried. I get asked this every night, you know, as I would, as I've been told, I asked for it. And I did. I asked for it by calling my narrator Pam. It was a long conversation with my editor, and in the end, she supported me, my new editor. She said, I called her, and I said, should I just... I'd had all these conversations with the lawyer, you know, and those are never fun, and... I said, should I just call myself Melinda? Should we just call me Melinda and get it over with? And she said, no. She said, we want them to think it's Pam and it's not Pam. And that's really important to me. This is just where I live as a writer. It's important to me to write from my own experience of the world. And it's important to me to be able to shape that into story, which often means changing it. And... you know, I am of the belief that if you want to read about a time and a place, if you read the fiction from that time and a place, you will have a much truer sense of what happened there than if you read the nonfiction. That's my belief, because in nonfiction, you have to keep protecting yourself and protecting others and protecting everything. So everything gets, not always, but sometimes things get a little whitewashed. I mean, we're in a time of, you know, of memoir, and nonfiction is very popular, and there's all kinds of terrific nonfiction books being written that use the tools of fiction to make themselves interesting and beautiful. I mean, it's kind of a renaissance, or I guess maybe it's just the explosion. I mean, when I went to school, there was no nonfiction. I mean, it wasn't an option to study. You know, it was fiction or poetry, and so for me, you know, I wrote this essay called Corn Maze, which is easily found on the internet at the moment if you just Google Pam Houston Corn Maze. And I talk at length about why I live here. Like, and it's got a lot to do with my personal history. My, you know, in an alcoholic household, in a violent alcoholic household, there's no such thing as how it really happened, you know? And there's no such thing as one thing following another, following another, following another. There's no such thing as logical chronology, you know? And I think that's probably a lot to do with why I gravitate to both this sort of what I would call a shattered narrative and also toward this, well, which way did it really happen? Sure.
And is it ever a problem?
Sure. Yeah.
You just have to be courageous.
I mean, it's no more a problem than it is for a nonfiction writer, mm-hmm. and possibly a little less of a problem, because, you know, I've changed their names and their locations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've changed many, many things about them. I mean, you know, one thing about this book, like people really have asked me, you know, well, what isn't true in here? And one thing that isn't true is that, I mean, this is just a simple thing, but there were too many women. There were too, I mean, I am blessed with a lot of women friends in my life, and there were too many for this novel, and everyone said so. And so I had to merge women. I had to merge women who are really different from each other and make them into one woman. And it was simply an editorial decision. You know, so that didn't have anything to do with anything. It didn't have anything to do with making the story better, although in someone's mind it was. You know, like it didn't make the story truer. It didn't protect anyone's identity. It was just simply that there were too many female names in this book. So I had to combine people. And it was hard because in my mind they're very distinct. But, you know, that's just one example. But
it sounds like you get to know the power of the story, and it just you just go with the power of the story.
Sure.
And it just takes you, guides you as much as you work it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. Like, I don't believe that language can represent reality. You know, like, that's a simple thing. But I don't believe it. I believe it can reach after it, and it can do better than I did, or maybe better than Jim Fry did. But I wasn't trying. I don't believe, you know, I believe our love of language is this unrequited thing. And I believe it's unrequited because it can never quite mean. It can't be the sky burial in Tibet. It can only reach after the sky burial in Tibet. So in my mind, it's like, well, if we're not going to really get there, like, let's do something else well. You know, like, let's make beautiful sentences and try to shape the story in a way that makes it more vivid, more appealing. You know, more true. You know, I don't have any doubt that I can get as much truth, whatever that means, you know, in a book of fiction as in a memoir. There are memoirs that feel so like it's gotten really inside the emotional truth, and there are novels that have too, and I don't think one has any sort of advantage over another.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.